Thanks very much. So it's very much a pleasure to be here today to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Institute. As Ross mentioned earlier, the RBA has been involved with the Institute, if somewhat surreptitiously, right from the beginning with Nugget's Coombs. Nowadays, our involvement is a bit more above the surface rather than below the surface, and it is quite an extensive involvement that we've had now for quite some time. And a public involvement, both in working together but also financially as well. So we don't have a surreptitious fund that we provide funding to the Melbourne Institute anymore. It's much more out there in the open. So the Institute has performed a preeminent role in the economic research and policy advice of the country. So what I'm going to talk about today is focus on its contributions in the macro area. But before I get to that, I'm going to head off on a slight tangent onto the cricket field. Now, for those of you who have read Ross's excellent book on the Institute, it's clear that the important position that cricket plays in the history of the Institute. And my association with a sizable number of the staff members of the Institute, both past and including some present members, is on the cricket field, at least to be more precise, on the indoor cricket field. Now, many of you know that a significant number of the Melbourne Institute staff spent their formative years at the National Institute of Labour Studies, or NILS, at Flinders Uni. Indeed, and I'll just switch seamlessly from cricket to baseball for a minute, NILS was basically the farm system for the Institute for quite a long time. So back in the mid-1980s, being the economic geek that I am, I used to work at NILS during my uni vacations. And as a result, I was a member of the highly acclaimed NILS indoor cricket side. So I'm going to run you through some of the key members of that team, a number of whom are sitting here in the audience today. So I used to open the batting with Robert Leeson, who, this is before Bob found Milton Friedman. So Bob and I were renowned for our kamikaze running between the wickets, particularly when we failed to lay bat on ball, which was actually most of the time. The next pair was one Peter Dorky Dawkins, fresh off the boat from England, and a recently minted national surf life-saving ski champion, one Mark Wooden. Our esteemed captain was NILS chief Dick Blandy. Now, this was probably the toughest gig that Dick ever had, to captain this side, a hell of a lot harder than running NILS and probably even harder than running the Melbourne Institute, even at the time that he came here. Other members of that team were Gary Goddard, who's now Deputy Under-Treasurer in South Australia, and Meredith Baker also made the odd cameo appearance. Now, I'm sure most of you are going to be stunned to hear that we are unable to coax then NILSite and future Productivity Commissioner, Melbourne Institute Professor, and sometime journalist Judy Sloan onto the field. So anyhow, as you can see, playing on that cricket team was a good leading indicator of employment at the Melbourne Institute, and indeed even a pretty good indicator of actually running the Melbourne Institute, which seamlessly takes me on to my main topic today, which is the Institute's contribution to macroeconomics. So I'm going to focus on three main areas of contribution by the Institute to the greater good of Australian macroeconomics. And the first is indeed leading indicators and business cycle analysis. The second is modelling and forecasting, and then the third is surveys. So let me start off with talking a bit about leading indicators and business cycle analysis. So for many years, the Institute has been associated with its series on leading indicators, to which it lends its name. A summary, you know, for those of you who aren't aware, which I assume is not anyone in this audience, but a leading indicator is a summary statistic that aims to predict economic activity. Now, personally, I'm not a great fan of leading indicators as a general rule, as I like to look at and think about the components of a leading indicator individually rather than attempt to summarise the information in one data series, particularly given that what matters at particular points in the cycle tends to vary through time. And in fact, to be frank, the NILS leading indicator of employment at the Melbourne Institute that I was talking about a minute ago probably does a better job of forecasting than the Melbourne Institute's leading indicator. That said, if one was going to use one leading indicator series in Australia, then it would indeed be the Melbourne Institute's one. And as an aside on this sort of topic of macroeconomic data, I was intrigued to learn from reading Ross's book, and he mentioned this earlier, that the Institute was the first body in Australia to publish seasonally adjusted and trend data before the ABS began to do so. And in fact, on a number of things, the Institute was doing things before the Australian Bureau of Statistics got there. And as I'm sure a number of you are in this room are well aware, the ABS had the opportunity to run the HILDA survey, declined. The Institute, thankfully, took up that responsibility, and we have what we have today, which I think the ABS today probably regrets not doing. Now, in terms of its contribution to business cycle analysis is another area where the Institute is particularly renowned. So through the work of Ern Boehm, Don Harding, and together with Adrian Pagan, the Institute has made a significant contribution to business cycle analysis. Those three gentlemen have generated a number of great papers on the topic of measuring and dating business cycles. They have produced the definitive body of work on that topic for the Australian economy, and out of that research has come what's most cited in terms of dating Australian business cycles. So let me turn to modelling. Now, Ross handled this delicate topic in the history of the Institute quite well, I think, in the book. I'm going to try and not offend anyone, particularly Peter Dixon, because having heard what it's like to be, from Ross's anecdote earlier, what it's like to be on the wrong end of Peter Dixon's wrath. But obviously, during the reign of Peter, the Melbourne Institute was very much synonymous with modelling. Now, the modelling by Peter Dixon, as well as that done by Peter Brain, was, of course, more of the CGE world, as Ross mentioned, than the macroeconomic world. Now, a crucial question on which I believe a lot of conferences were held during the 70s and 80s was how those two things interacted. Now, I'm told by those who can remember that a fair bit of time was trying to spend marrying the short-term forecast, which came out of the Reserve Bank model and the Treasury model. So the Reserve Bank one run by Peter Johnson and the Treasury model under Chris Higgins, how those two models could be made to interact with the CGE model at the Institute. Now, I thought that could have been a fairly brief conference working out how those two could have been could interact, but as it turns out, many conferences were spent on this topic. The question was never, well, was never really answered, which probably tells you what the actual answer to the question was. Nevertheless, I believe there were a lot of fruitful discussions held as to how to marry those two things. Anyway, the Melbourne Institute's CGE modelling, though, was of great value to a number of its corporate clients at the time, not in terms of generating macro forecasts, but in terms of analysing other policy issues. But besides the modelling side of the things, the Institute regularly publishes, now I believe this stopped for a while, but it's back on again now, as Ross mentioned earlier, but regularly publish an assessment of the Australian economy in the Australian Economic Review, as well as discuss the outlook for the economy. Now, Ross talked about how in the 70s in particular, what the Institute was putting out was fairly controversial, at least at odds with that which was coming out from the official sector. Now, in my undergraduate days in the Eric Russell Room in the Adelaide Uni Economics Department, that I assiduously used to read those assessments, which I, from memory, came out quarterly in the Australian Economic Review in those days. Now, at that time, there was basically no other source of macroeconomic commentary out there. The financial markets economists that Ross was talking about earlier were really only in their infancy. Now, one could argue as to whether that is indeed still the case, but anyhow, at those days, they were at least in a chronological sense still in their infancy. There was no such thing as a quarterly statement of monetary policy coming out of the Reserve Bank. In fact, the Reserve Bank really published very little in terms of macro commentary in those days. You only really had the budget papers coming out once a year, which published an assessment of the macro economy. So really, the quarterly assessments in the Australian Economic Review were basically the only substantive form of macroeconomic information at the time. And so I think it was actually to the Institute's great credit that it put that out. That was an important contribution, as Ross mentioned, to the policy discussion in Australia, particularly in the 70s and 80s and around the development of an incomes policy with the work that Peter Sheehan did on that topic. And it was also, I think, and coming back to my own anecdote, and a particularly important contribution to the education of budding macroeconomists in the country at the time. As I said, there really wasn't any other form of economic commentary that one could read about. And I think that was a great public service and educative service that the Institute provided in those days. But it's in the area of surveys, I think, that the Melbourne Institute has made its most significant and enduring contribution to the state of Australian macroeconomics. Its name is synonymous with some of the highest profile and longest running surveys in Australia. And much of that contribution can be attributed to the foresight and work of Duncan Ironmonger. So the first of these that I'll talk about are the surveys on consumers, which were based on the surveys conducted at the University of Michigan, and Ross talked about the lengths that the Institute had back in those days with the Union of Michigan. So the Melbourne Institute survey of consumer sentiment has a long-running history back to 1974, and I'm pleased to note that actually the Reserve Bank of Australia provided some of the funding for the survey at its inception. But the length of that data series, back to 74, means that for consumers, we have a time series that spans a number of business cycles, something that cannot be said of quite a few other time series, including basically all of the business surveys. So in addition to the time series information that that survey provides and the long time series information that that survey provides, there's also invaluable cross-sectional information inside that survey that has proven useful in informing macro policy settings. So we spend quite a lot of time at the bank going through all the various components of that survey and breaking it down by different demographic groups and whatever, extracting as much information as we possibly can out of it. Now, out of that survey of consumers also comes the series on inflation expectations. Now, the behaviour of this time series has long befuddled many macroeconomists and complicated the life of those inclined to estimate Phillips curves, as I've done a fair bit of in my youth, and as Ian has obviously done a fair bit of in his time as well. So if you look at the time series of that survey of consumer expectations, certainly before the 1990s, basically it's just one big straight line. So if the right-hand side variable is not moving, that does complicate the estimate of a left-hand side variable, which is moving around a bit, obviously. So basically, one could broadly describe that series as a horizontal line which had a structural shift downwards sometime in the early 1990s. So anyhow, as I said, that's occupied a fair bit of our time at the Reserve Bank trying to work out what the hell was going on with this series. And my colleague at the Reserve Bank, Jackie Dwyer, spent a lot of time working with Don Harding in the mid-1990s to try to understand what exactly was going on with the inflation expectations survey by looking at what actually people were doing in terms of individual responses to the survey. So if you remember at that time in the mid-1990s, that we were in the infancy of the inflation targeting period, and we were trying to get a clean read on what the public's assessment was of the credibility of that of the new policy regime that had only been in place for a few years. And you know, at least from the face of it, one obvious way to do that was to look at what was going on in terms of inflation expectations. Anyway, as a result of that delving by Jackie and Don, they came up with a number of refinements to the nature of the survey, including the way the questions were asked and the way that the data was cleaned up. So one of the problems they discovered was a round number problem. So respondents to the survey on inflation expectations tend to answer either 0, 5 or 10. And they were basically the three answers that people gave, and sometimes they're actually numbers a lot larger than 10 as well. So that 0, 5 or 10, or at least certainly 5 or 10, was probably a reasonable response in the 70s and into the 80s, but really didn't make much sense in the 1990s and beyond. And also it turns out that people were not that great with percentages and found it hard to distinguish between levels and changes when it came to prices and when it came to answering that question. As a result of that digging by Jackie and Don, the survey methodology was updated to better reflect the low inflation environment we were in the 1990s. And consequently, the time series since the early 1990s is much more nuanced and explicable and actually has a decent amount of variation. There's now quite a reasonable cluster of responses at 2 and 3%, which is obviously pleasing from our point of view. Now, one could say that it's somewhat suspect that after we got hold of the series and cleaned it up, it suddenly started showing what we wanted it to show, but anyway. As I said, there was a lot of good work, and again, showing the collaboration between the bank and the institute at the there was a lot of good work by Jackie and Don in working on generating a much more usable and sensible series. Now that the inflation expectation series has been cleaned up, we only need to come up with a decent measure of the output gap. So I throw that out as a challenge to the macro staff at the Melbourne Institute, and then we'd be able to estimate Phillips curves till the cows come home. Whether that is a socially useful experiment, use of one's resources is another question, but anyway. Don Harding's other contribution in the area of inflation was his work with Steve Kokoulos, who was then at Toronto Dominion, in generating the monthly series on inflation. And this comes back to another tension where basically the Institute's got in ahead of the Australian Bureau of Statistics. So this series is still published jointly by the Institute and Toronto Dominion. Australia remains one of only two advanced countries, the other being New Zealand, without an official monthly CPI series. So Don and Steve worked on generating a monthly series, including through some innovative use of electronic data, so looking at what data was out there available on the net, and I think also looking at what you can get from scanner data. So now we have that monthly CPI series. The ABS only publishes a quarterly CPI series, but we do have the Melbourne Institute TD monthly series on inflation to look at. The final survey that I want to talk about that the Melbourne Institute, I think, at least today, is most associated with is the Hilda survey. So this longitudinal study was based on the similar surveys around the world, including in particular the PSID in the United States, and tracks, as most of you know, a set of households through time. So while much of the information in the survey is more useful for social policy rather than macro policy, at least at the face of it, there is still a wealth of information in it that has been and continues to be of great use to the Bank and Treasury in their macro policy decision making and in their macro policy advice. It has enabled analysis of the macro issues to be conducted by aggregating from the micro data in a way that simply wasn't possible before. In the end, of course, macro behaviour is simply the summation of a whole set of micro decisions. So to be able to use the Hilda series to actually have a look at how households are making decisions on a micro basis is immensely valuable. So the Hilda survey is very much in the tradition of Ronald Henderson. It is a very rich source of data that can be used to analyse a vast number of socioeconomic questions. Now, I'm sure others will spend a lot of time over the rest of the day talking about it, but I think it's the Institute's great credit that it took on the coordination of this important component of understanding the Australian economy when other institutions were unwilling to do so. And that the work that Mark Wooden has done in overseeing that survey, I think, is to his great credit and to the great credit of the Institute. The bank, the Reserve Bank, funded in another one of our direct funding involvements with the Institute. We funded a wealth module in the Hilda survey in its initial iteration, which has subsequently been incorporated into the survey as a whole every 4 years. And many of my colleagues, particularly in the financial stability area, have made extensive use of the Hilda data in gaining a better understanding of the distribution of household debt in the Australian economy, as well as household savings patterns. So if you read our semi-annual financial stability reviews, there is always quite a large chunk of information about how household debt has evolved and how that's distributed across households. Now, on the second one, the only information we have from that and the very rich source of information we have on that is the Hilda survey. So what we've been able to get from that is the finding that with the rise in household debt since the mid-1990s in Australia, most of that debt has been held by the upper end of the income distribution and by the older people. So it's basically a whole bunch of rich baby boomers who have loaded up on their debts to screw their grandchildren out of their inheritance. But anyway, that's another topic. Analysis of the distribution of household debt has been immensely important for us in understanding the transmission of monetary policy in Australia. It's actually been extremely important for us, given that when I go ashore and talk about the Australian economy, one of the main risks that people overseas tend to throw at us is about household debt. And the fact that we have that information which comes out of the Hilda survey to provide a much more nuanced understanding of that debt, I think, has been actually quite useful in assuaging people's concerns on that front. If you look at the research output of the bank's research department over the last few years, quite a sizable share, and I suspect it's probably somewhere between a third and a half of the bank's research output, has involved analysis of the Hilda data. And Ross mentioned earlier, and I was talking to Mark earlier about the impact, research impact work done last week. I mean, I think if you look in terms of the outcomes which have come from the Hilda survey, it just shows how much impact that's had on both macro, I don't know how much it's had on the macro policy front, and you can measure that by the amount of research papers we put out which uses it, as well as the fact that we talk about it every 6 months in the financial stability reviews, let alone its impact on a whole bunch of other areas of social policy. So seems to me that it's one case where the sort of impact or policy impact of that that research program is extremely obvious. Finally, one noteworthy contribution to the macro policy debate that doesn't completely fit within my taxonomy is that of Peter Dawkins in injecting the Melbourne Institute squarely into the debate around unemployment, building on the work that Dick did when he came to the Institute earlier in the 90s. So some of you might remember Peter's critical role in the Five Economists letter back in 1998, which basically moved unemployment right into, that did actually get a lot of coverage on the front page of the newspaper. And those the work that Dick and then later Peter did in terms of advocacy on that topic has sort of, I think, basically flowed into the Economic and Social Outlook conference and very much cemented the Institute's role in the national debate, particularly on unemployment and the labour market. So in conclusion, and to go back to the anecdote I was talking about at the beginning, the Melbourne Institute has reached its half century. And while these days the Institute is probably more associated with its work in the areas of the labour market and social policy, over its 50-year history, the Institute has made a substantial contribution to Australian macro. In particular, I think its most significant and lasting contribution has been in instituting a number of important surveys, most prominently the Consumer Sentiment Survey, the Inflation Expectation Survey, and more recently the Hilda Panel Data Series. So the information from these surveys have facilitated a much better quality of macro analysis in the country than would have been available without them. In doing so, they have undoubtedly improved the quality of macro policy making and outcomes, which was one of the founding goals of the Melbourne Institute. So on behalf of the macro policy making community of Australia over the past 50 years, and in particular my colleagues at the Bank and at Treasury, I'd like to thank the Melbourne Institute and particularly the staff for their contribution in the area of macroeconomics, and I trust the Institute will be able to convert this half century into a ton. So thank you very much. Bob.
Yeah, Guy, this is a 50-year anniversary, and when you look back over 50 years, it's clear that, to me anyway, that the ability to make a contribution 50 years ago, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, it was much greater than it is now. You talked about, being ahead of the ABS and doing things, getting the first surveys out, all that sort of thing. And Deborah talked about how difficult it is nowadays, in a sense, there's much more competition around. So as an outsider, and for someone who's not even had any notice of this question, can you conjecture where a big contribution might be for the Institute in the next 10, 15, 20 years? I mean, can you see in any way some sort of gap or role which is not more of the same, as it were? And I don't want this to be a considered answer, because it's not fair, but it just comes to mind, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think Hilda was the one, that was a massive gap. Put it this way. Actually, longitudinal data generally was the large hole that we had in Australia. Now, Hilda's addressed that on the household side of things in a way which has been incredibly useful. Now, I think there have been a few attempts at this, but one could also think of something along on the business side in terms of having a decent business longitudinal survey, which has come and gone at various stages in the country's history, but statistical history at least. That seems to me that, particularly around small business, actually, and which Hilda does get at this to some point, because as we've continually reminded, I mean, small businesses are mostly households, and so the decision making is very much the same. But actually, I think we've done a bit of work over the past year or two at the bank on small business finance, coming from our side of things. But actually, in terms of understanding small businesses more generally, there's actually quite a large hole there. And actually, the methodology that you use for Hilda, including a fair chunk of just the infrastructure of Hilda, I think could usefully be used to looking at that sort of question, where I think there is a fairly large gap in the sort of knowledge base of policy, well, both policymakers and researchers in the country. So off the top of my head, I'll throw that one out there.
Yeah, hi, Guy. Greg Roberts. I'm with Australian Associated Press. Look, I was just wondering if you'd be able to share any thoughts you might have on the major banks not passing on interest rate cut and fall. Whether you think their reasons are valid.
There's another research area for the Institute, right? is to come up with trite answers to this question.
But probably just specifically reasons such as funding costs.
Anyhow, I'd rather just talk about the topic today, thanks. Yeah, I hope that hasn't made your trip completely fruitless. Hopefully you gained something out of the other conversations that we're having here today.
Good morning. Miranda Maxwell from Reuters News. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that policy had been quite influenced by the HILDA data. I'm just wondering how much housing and the price of housing and the related debt factors in the policy decisions that we've had, and how difficult that is, to cut interest rates as the bank has been and to avoid asset bubbles. If you could just talk about that.
We spend a lot of time analysing the debt issue is as much from the financial stability issue and that side of things as it is from the monetary policy, but it actually influenced both. And I said before we had the HILDA data, we had much less of an understanding. Well, we had very little understanding about the distribution of that debt. So with the large increase in household debt from the mid-90s until the mid-2000s, we had very little... we had a sense that it wasn't equivalent to the US situation where much of the increase in debt that they had over that time was with the low end of the income distribution. But it wasn't until we had the HILDA data that actually able to confirm that much of the increase in debt was actually being held by the upper end of the income distribution, and that which has... reasonably, it probably has at least as strong implications for the financial stability side of things and the strength of the banking sector as it does for macro policy. But it actually was important in terms of thinking about how monetary policy changes might are transmitted through to the rest of the economy.
One last question. Yeah, hi. Last weekend in the press, Lindsay Tanner wrote a very interesting article on the problem between moving from the sort of rational view of policy formation of the last 30 years or so and the current populist sort of dilemma we find ourselves in. Given some of the previous questions in the discussion, any thoughts on how we move on from the indicators or indices to thinking sort of left field about a populist indicator or indice that can actually help us cut through, I guess, particularly dealing with, as Deborah said before, the challenge of social media, the 24/7 real-time news cycle, stuff like that. It would seem to me that's an area of innovation where perhaps we can bring along a lot more of the general public in this. You mentioned the SME sector, I agree. I think that's one that really does need to be brought into this. So any thoughts on how we might think laterally here and address this populist issue? Tanner also said he felt we would move on to something else, but he couldn't describe what it was.
I mean, I suppose our approach, at least at the bank, is we just try to keep... I mean, one is keep on putting out the same message again and again and again and hope that eventually cuts through. And by the time you've said it, you're completely bored of saying it yourself. It's about the time that it finally does actually cut through. So coming to Deborah's point she was making earlier, regardless of the medium that you're using and... indeed, we. I believe the bank has been on Twitter for about a year now. I'm not sure. Not sure whether that's to the greater good of society, but anyhow, I personally don't know how to do it. But in terms of getting your message out there, one of the things is to sort of almost do it until you're completely sick of hearing the message yourself. By which time, it's probably about the time that everyone else is paying attention. So. And by repeating the same message again and again and again is one way to cut through on whatever it is, the topic that you want to make a contribution to. So, but I think it is important, though, and even, I mean, we face obviously not the same sort of pressures that the Institute faces, but, there are obviously considerations you have to have, but actually getting out there and repeating that message again and again in whatever form it is, whether it's delivering speeches or in written form, at least I think eventually you do cut through, but you do have to keep on putting that message out there again and again and again.